I'd like to begin by reading a story written by a man who has a gift for explaining some of the larger issues of life in stories about everyday things. His name is Robert Fulghum. He's written several books. Probably his best known was All I Really Need to Know, I Learned in Kindergarten. But he wrote another one entitled It Was on Fire When I Lay Down on It. I won't even explain the title. But I would like to read this one little story he has. After the dishes are washed and the sink rinsed out, there remains in the strainer at the bottom of the sink what I will call momentarily some stuff. A rational, intelligent, objective person would say that this is simply a mixture of food particles too big to go down the drain, composed of bits and of protein, carbohydrates, fat and fiber, sort of dinner dandruff. Furthermore, the person might add that not only was the material first sterilized by the high heat of cooking, but further sanitized by going through the detergent and hot water of the dishpan and rinsed. No problem. But any teenager who has been dragooned into washing dishes knows that this is a lie. That stuff in the bottom of the strainer is toxic waste. Deadly poison, a danger to health, in other words, about as icky gets. One of the very few reasons I had any respect for my mother when I was 13 was because she would reach into the sink with her bare hands, and pick up that lethal gunk and drop it into the garbage. To top that, I saw her reach into the wet garbage bag and fish around in there looking for a lost teaspoon, barehanded. Kind of a mad courage. She found the spoon in a clump of coffee grounds mixed with scrambled egg remains and the end of the vegetable soup. I almost passed out when she handed it to me to rinse off. No teenager who wanted to live would have touched that without being armed with gloves, a face mask, and stainless steel tongs. Once in school, I came across the French word ordure. And when the teacher told me it meant unspeakable filth, I knew exactly to what it referred. We had it every night in the bottom of our sink. When I reported my new word to my mother at dishwashing time, she gave me her my son the idiot look and explained that the dinner I had just eaten was in just about the same condition in my stomach at the moment, rotting, and it hadn't even been washed and rinsed before it went down my drain. If she had given me a choice between that news and being hit across the head with a 2x4, I would have gone for the board. I lobbied long and hard for a disposal and automatic dishwasher, knowing full well that they had been invented so that nobody would ever have to touch that gunk again. Never mind what any parent or objective adult might tell me, I knew that the stuff in the sink drainer was lethal and septic. It would give you leprosy or something worse. If you should ever accidentally touch it, you must never touch any other part of your body with your fingers until you had scalded and soaped and rinsed your hands. Even worse, I knew that the stuff could congeal and mush up and mutate into some living thing that would crawl out of the sink during the night and get loose in the house. Why not just use rubber gloves, you ask? Oh, come on. Rubber gloves are for sissies. Remember, my mother used her bare hands. My father never came closer than 3 feet to the sink in his life. My mother said he was lazy, but I knew that he knew what I knew about the gunk. Once after dinner, I said to him, I bet Jesus never had to wash dishes and clean the gunk out of the sink. He agreed. It was the only theological discussion we ever had. My father, however, would take a plunger to the toilet when it was stopped up with even worse stuff. I wouldn't even go in the room when he did it. I didn't want to know. But now I am a grown-up and have been for some time. And I imagine making a speech to a high school graduating class. First, I would ask them, how many of you would like to be an adult, an independent, on your own citizen? All would raise their hands with some enthusiasm. Then I would give them this list of things that grown-ups do. Clean the sink strainer, plunge out the toilet, clean up babies when they poop and pee, wipe runny noses, clean up the floor when the baby throws strange spinach, clean ovens and grease traps and roasting pans, empty the kitty box and scrape up the dog mess, carry out the garbage, pump out the bilges, bury dead pets when they get run over in the street. I'd tell the graduates that when they can do these things, they will be adults. Some of the students might not want to go on at this point, but they may as well face the truth. It can get even worse than the list suggests. My wife is a doctor, and I won't tell you what she tells me she has to do sometimes. I wish I didn't know. I feel ill at ease sometimes being around someone who does those things. I also feel proud. The willingness to do your share of cleaning up the mess is a test. And taking out the garbage of this life is a condition of membership in the community. When you were a kid, you feel that if they really loved you, they wouldn't ever ask you to take out the garbage. When you join the ranks of the grown-ups, you take out the garbage because you love them. And by them, I mean not only your own family, but the family of humankind. The old cliche holds firm and true. Being an adult is dirty work, but somebody has to do it. That's a story about leadership. That's what it's a story about. That's what he's writing to. And you know, he's right. One of the reasons why life is set up where the adults lead the children is because of having an ability and a willingness to do the dirty work of life. And he's also right when he talks about maturity. One of the marks of maturity is not turning 21. It's not getting the job you wanted. It's not getting out on your own apartment for the first time. It's not graduating from college. It's not getting married. It's not being able to make babies. That's not the mark of maturity. The mark of maturity is the willingness to do a lot of dirty work. And there's all sorts of things in life that are dirty work. And by dirty work, I mean things that we would rather not do, but for the sake of others, we will do them. For the sake of other people, we will do them. One of the marks of growing up is when we're willing to tackle the garbage of life, both your own and the garbage that sometimes other people throw at you, and to be able and willing to handle. And there's a lot of garbage in life. Now, I'm not talking about physical garbage. The physical garbage, that's the easy stuff. But the emotional, the mental, the spiritual, those are the areas of life that really mess up life. There's a lot of garbage in that area, and there's a lot of garbage that is dumped on people in the world today. False values, sin, concepts of what happiness is and how to get it that are mistaken concepts, lack of love, abuse that comes in so many forms, all sorts of hurts. And that type of garbage has touched all of our lives in certain ways. To one degree or another, we've all been touched by that. And the world just cranks out. I can't believe at home sometimes how much garbage we make, you know. The average family, you know, every week you take it out, you say, where did this come from? Well, it's byproducts of life. But the worst garbage is the stuff that gets dumped on us all the time in the world we live in. I want to talk to you today about developing godly leadership. Developing godly leadership. This is not an issue of where I'm going to ask you how many of you would like to be leaders, because it's not whether you want to be. You are. Every one of us in here are leaders. And by leader, I mean someone who influences other people's lives. That's what it is. Somebody who influences other people's lives. And that can be good or it can be bad. But the moment we influence somebody else's life to have them go in a certain direction, we have exercised leadership in their lives. And we will lead others in certain directions. And all of us are leaders because the most fundamental area of leadership is that we have to lead our own lives, don't we? We have to govern our own direction in life. The moment that God gave us freedom of choice, leadership became an issue for every one of us. What standards will we lead our decision-making, or will lead our decision-making? What governs our thinking is what leads us. A great deal of the quality in your life, a great deal, the vast majority of the quality of your life will be determined by the principles of leadership that you consider and that you choose and that you develop, first in your personal life, but also in the way you affect others. We can talk a lot about leadership. There are many elements of it, but today I want to focus especially for our young people. If you want to title this, you can call it The Heart and Core of Godly Leadership. The heart and core of godly leadership. It's for everybody in here because it's a lifelong process, but the young people have a wonderful opportunity to learn some things and understand and make certain decisions in life that will just totally alter the direction that your life goes. So there's a lot we could talk about, but if we end this message with an understanding of the heart and core of it, we will have accomplished what I would like to accomplish today. I'd like to start with an example that shows two general ways of perceiving leadership. Let's go to 1 Kings chapter 12. In 1 Kings 12, we have a situation in the history of Israel where one king was dying or had died just recently, and another was to take over. It's always interesting. We've just gone through that in our country, and everybody's wondering, what direction will our new leader take us? Some are less worried about that than they were about potential leaders that could have gone into areas. But whatever your concept is, we all know that the leadership of our nation will take us in a certain direction. When I say leadership, I don't mean just the president. There was leadership exercised in the duties of the Supreme Court and in the Congress. And we have a system that's called balances, checks and balances, where there are three distinct areas of leadership that all work together to provide a singular direction for the nation. But it's always a concern. And it was back at this time, too. So after Solomon died, there was a delegation that came to his son. Now his son, we read in verse 3, his son was named Rehoboam, and there's a lot more to this story than what I'm going to go through. It's a very interesting account. But beginning in verse 3, it says, "They sent and called him. Then Jeroboam and the whole congregation of Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam." And they said, from the perspective of the congregation here, we have a request. Your father made our yoke heavy. Now Solomon built a temple. He built many other things. And whatever it was, it was a burden on everybody to provide for everything that the nation had been developing. So he said, "Now therefore lighten the burdensome service of your father and put his heavy yoke which he put on us, and we will serve you." So he said to them, "Depart for 3 days, let me think on it, then come back." So the people departed. Then King Rehoboam consulted the elders who stood before his father Solomon while he still lived. And he did what a good leader should do. He said, "How do you advise me to answer these people?" And they spoke to him saying, "If you will be a servant to these people today and serve them, and answer them, and speak good words to them," like we heard in the sermonette, how powerful that will be. Notice what he says, "They will be your servants forever." Now, isn't that a bit strange? Interesting. First thing he tells the king is, "Why don't you serve them?" And then he says, "If you serve them, they'll serve you." What does this mean? This isn't leadership, is it? Isn't leadership about being over people? Isn't leadership about saying, wake up in the morning and say, "What do I want today? I'll fetch me somebody who'll get what I want." Now, we're going to see some interesting things about this. They told him, you are the king, serve. You are the king, serve them. They did not answer his specific question. The question that Jeroboam brought was, lighten this load. The elders went to the heart of the matter. They said, let's talk about a principle here. The principle is, serve them, speak good words to them, answer them, and if you do, if this is the way you operate your kingdom, they will serve you forever. He was already their king, but they were not yet his servants. And there's a big difference between being a king and being a leader, a godly leader, I should say. He was the leader already. He had inherited that. But what type of leader would he be depended on his heart? Let me go on. Verse 8. But he rejected the counsel which the elders gave him. Question, why? Why would he reject that? He consulted the young men who had grown up with him, who stood before him, and he said to them, what counsel do you give? How should we answer this people who have spoken to me, saying, lighten the load which your father put on us? Then the young men who had grown up with him spoke to him, saying, all right, this is what you tell them. You tell them your father made our yoke heavy. My little finger will be thicker than my father's waist. What motivated that? Where were they coming from? Why? Why would they say that? There have been many, many kings in life in many, many countries. In fact, that's one of the great stories of history, one of the most common stories of history, is following this philosophy. And so that's what he did. But why did he reject that? Well, it's because humans are inclined. We all have an inclination in this area of life. Our human nature, we are either inclined to serve or to be served. We have natural leanings, and he was predisposed already to take advice that would appeal to his selfish side. And so he led the people. He did. He led them right into dividing the country. You can read the rest of the chapter. He led them into things like changing. Jeroboam. He didn't take them off in any better path. But Rehoboam led them into actions, because you see, once we institute an action, there's a reaction. And once somebody reacts, there's another action, and there's another reaction. And this is why godly leadership is so important, because everybody reacts. So he rejected, unfortunately. They had needs, and he had wants. They had needs, and he had wants. He had the authority and the power. And brethren, there is nothing wrong with authority and power. People who talk about getting upset at authority and power have no concept of what they're talking about. It goes throughout life. It has to be in life. Any of you young people want to get married someday? You better start learning about authority and power, because it's going to be the heart, and it's going to be right at what you do every day. It's not authority and power that's the problem. It's how it's used. The heart of governing. So this illustrates two ways of perceiving leadership. One said, you serve them and they will serve you. Why would that be? Because there's a response. There's a response to somebody who serves other people. It does something in the relationships between people. It makes people respond in a certain way, but the way he took it made them respond in a different way. How often do you have opportunity as young people to exercise opportunities for leadership? Well, it happens every day. You've already had opportunity today to exercise some form of leadership. The moment you interacted with other people, for example, you've had opportunities. Mr. Sport gave a sermonette that highlighted opportunities that we've already had today. Many opportunities arise in life. When we have a chance to influence or affect someone else's life, if we do it for the better, It's godly. If we do it for the worse, it's worldly. Leadership, Stephen Covey says very astutely, leadership is growing in your life the ability to have responsibility. But he makes an interesting observation about the word. You know where we get the word responsibility? It comes from two different words, response and ability. And as he brings out, it's the ability to respond correctly to any given situation. A person who is responsible, when you think of somebody who's responsible, what you're actually saying is, here's somebody who has a track record where they have demonstrated the ability to respond correctly to life. That's a responsible person, able to respond in a right way to any given situation. When other people have needs, especially, when there are needs of other people, the person who can respond to their needs appropriately is learning some things about leadership in a godly way. It's godly leadership. A lot of times there are people in life who could respond, but they don't. They could respond, but they don't. The reason goes back to that fundamental law. We are either inclined to serve or we are inclined to be served. The person who is inclined to serve will tend toward responding to people's needs. Some people who are not inclined to serve, they will either not see the needs or they will ignore the needs. And that is not godly leadership. There are people who just don't think, what are the needs of others? They don't consider, do I have the ability to respond to those needs? You will learn in life, there are either people who exist to be served or to serve. They are givers or they are takers. That's the way life is, givers and takers, serving others or serving self. You know, it's very interesting when you start looking at these things in the Bible. You don't find great long chapters of the Bible or stacks of verses about organizational advice in the Bible. You can draw hints and ideas here and there, but you don't find just, you know, great focus on that. But you do find that the Bible is rich with instruction about leadership. It's full of guidance about leadership and responsibilities and how to discharge them. And what the Bible emphasizes and what God kept for us is that He focuses on not the way times change and things like that. He focuses on what is constant throughout all of time, what is always going to be the main issue. He focuses on attitude and character and righteousness. That's what God really focuses on, and therefore the attention that is primarily given in the Bible on leadership has to do with righteousness and righteous behavior. This is something that you find from beginning to end, and you find it something that Jesus talked about a lot as well. Let's go to Matthew chapter 20 and look at an example here. In Matthew 20, these were not people who were well advanced in years. These were relatively young people. Probably, if we lived back then, we would have said these would fit in the category of young adults today. People that Jesus Christ had called to develop and to work with and to teach as His disciples. There was a lot that they had to learn, as we all do. In Matthew 20, verses 17 through 19, He is explaining to them as they were going down the road, he told them what was going to happen to Him, that He was going to die. He was going to be crucified. He would be raised again. And somewhere along in this time, verse 20, then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Him with her sons. And She knelt down and asked something of him. She came and she said, "I've got a little favor. Just a little favor. I appreciate you taking my boys these last 3 years. You've been so good to them. They've learned, so they just talk about you all the time. And I just, there's just some, one little thing that you would, I know you'll listen to this old Jewish mother. I made some matzos for you too, by the way. My boys, you know, just a little thing. Would you let, when you go to the kingdom, now think about this. He just told them, I'm going to be crucified and die. She's saying, but when you get there, you know, when you get in the kingdom, would you, she said, grant that these two sons of mine, little Jimmy, little Petey, I guess it was James and John, wasn't it? Little Johnny boy and little Jimmy. Would you grant that one sit on your right hand and one sit on your left hand? I know you've got a throne and I know you're going to have all these seats up there, but if you just let one sit on the right and one sit on the left. Grant that one sit on your right hand and the other on the left in your kingdom. Jesus answered and said, you don't know what you're asking. She's probably thinking, yeah, I do. One on the right, one on the left. This is not real hard. I don't think these seats are taken yet, so. And he said, no, are you able to drink the cup that I'm about to drink and to be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? And before they said, what exactly are you talking about? They said, sure, we're able. They weren't thinking real clearly, because when people get in the mindset, I want something, we tend to sometimes gloss over some of the details. We don't think things through carefully. He said to them, you will indeed drink my cup and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with. Do you know what? I can't give that to you. To sit on my right hand or on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it is prepared by my Father. Now, there are a number of interesting concepts to understand here. What we see being played out here is the difference between politics and leadership. It's the difference between politics and leadership. Politics is when we use one's position or one's influence or one's power for personal advantage, to get something that we want for ourselves, regardless of what others may need. Now, true godly leadership is not political. True godly leadership just isn't political. Politics has to do with manipulating authority, or, you know, it's related to government. The problem is not government. The problem is when politics enters in, and politics can play all sorts of roles in life. A child, a little child who starts working mom against dad, is practicing politics in the family realm of government. And some of them can be very good at it. They're not concerned about what are the needs of the family, it's what I've got to figure out a way to get what I want. So this was going on here. This was a mother, and mothers can be very influential at times, you know. When mama wants something for her boys, you know, mamas look after their kids. And that's what she was doing. That's what Mrs. Zebedee was doing. And she was looking after her boys, and she wanted something. Now, brethren, the fact that politics can exist among people, even among the disciples, even in the church, that shouldn't dismay us. It's part of life. I mean, it may dismay us, but it should not shock us. It should not shock us, because that's the natural way of governing life that humans know. That's what we fall back on. That's what is natural to most people. Most people are incoming. It's part of human nature. And it manifests itself in many ways. The government, what governs people, is me first. That's human nature. It governs human beings all the time. We can expect it. It's where the test of life comes from. It's where Christ was tested. You know, when Satan took him up to test him in the wilderness, he tested him in the three primary areas of thinking that govern human thought, that govern human decision-making. John wrote about it in 1 John 2. He says these three broad areas are the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. Those things tend to drive most people. That's where Satan tested Christ. And Satan said, you know, command these stones be made bread. Throw yourself down and see if his angels will bear you up. And finally, he just said, you can have it all. Just worship me. Satan was going after something, and Christ had to reject all of that thinking, because all of that thinking would have turned him away from what he came for, and it would have been centered on me first. When me first comes in, and the way humans relate to one another, it's always at the expense of somebody else. Somebody else suffers. What Mrs. Z was asking for here was at the expense of somebody else. Who? What about the other 10? She didn't come and say, you know, when you go to your kingdom, I realize there's only two seats right beside you. I have a suggestion. Why don't we set up a rotating basis? One gets 2 months on the right, and then they'll just shift one down, and the next one comes in. And that way it'll be fair to everybody. They'll all get to sit beside you. Nuh-uh. She's thinking about my boys. It's natural. And I don't say this to condemn her, because we've all done that in one way or another. Now, that was the me first. She was thinking about leadership. I want my boys to be leaders. And leadership means sitting right up there by the head guy. Now, Christ did not see it that way. But that drives and guides a lot of the thinking of people today. The me first idea says, indulge your desires, satiate whatever appetites you have, pursue pleasure, take off restraints, go after what you want. Go after what you want. You can have it all. That mindset is based on a very vague and hazy promise. It's the same promise that started out from the beginning. It's based on the promise, though, that if you will seek your own good and if you will satisfy your own desires, then you'll be happy. You'll be happy if you do that. And that road to contentment and satisfaction and happiness in life is regulated by this big flashing light that says, me first, me first, me first. So that's what drives people, and it's very deceitful. Mrs. Zebedee and James and John were fooled momentarily. They were fooled. Now, what resulted out of all this? I told you earlier, for every action, there's a reaction. Well, you know what happened. Proverbs says, when the righteous in authority, the people rejoice. Was there a lot of rejoicing here? Did the other 10 say, she just beat us to the punch? I mean, we've been thinking all the time, these two deserve the right spot there. We took a vote on it, you know, and yeah, you bet. Put them at the right hand. No, verse 24, when the 10 heard it, they were moved with indignation against the two brothers. They got mad at the two brothers. Now, the reaction and the displeasure of the 10 tells us they too were tuned in to this competitive thinking. They were tuned in to that. They shared with James and John the same misconceptions, or else they would not have gotten up in arms this way. The Word of God says, great peace have those who love your law, and nothing shall offend them. The law of God that governs leadership, they would have understood this. They would have seen what the problem was. They would have said, oh boy, you know, I'm going to take my brother aside and explain this to him, you know. No, they got mad. They were indignant. They would not have done that if they would have understood that the value and the purpose of godly leadership is not for self, it's not for personal gain, it's not for prestige or position. They were operating from a different model. They were operating from the model they knew. And that model is what Jesus called the Gentile model, the world's model. We in this room find ourselves, you know, we're nobody in this room is a perfect leader. And nobody, I hope nobody in this room operates solely from the world's model, but we're somewhere along the line in between, moving out of the world's way and continually trying to learn the way of God, His model. So Jesus launched into a very powerful and forceful talk about righteous leadership. He called them to Himself. Okay, huddle up. He said, You take a look around, you can complain about the world. You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. That's how many have their greatness. That's what Jeroboam was trying to do. Jeroboam said, no, I'm going to establish my greatness by making it tough on them. I won't give them a way out. They will have no choice. That's the way the world operates so often. They use and they manipulate to maintain their power. And he said in verse 26, yet it shall not be so among you. It can't be. Now all of you teenagers sitting out here, young people, what am I talking about here? I'm talking about your future marriage. I'm talking about going to school. I'm talking about your career, how you're going to approach people on the job. I'm talking about friendships. I'm talking about relating in all ways to other people. I'm talking about serving in the church. I'm talking about 30, 40 years from now. You know, God willing, we won't be around here 30 or 40 years from now, but however long, 10, 20, 30, whenever you are at X age, 40 years old, I'm talking about how you're going to be relating to the way of God and the church. It's all about this. It's about every aspect of life. It shall not be so among you. Whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. Again, this is strange to people. Let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Now, what do we see in real life, everyday life right now that comes out of this? What about this issue of greatness? Whoever desires to be great. How many of you desire to be great in life? Don't raise your hands. I don't want to embarrass you. But you know what? I hope if you think this through, you'd all raise your hands. Because greatness takes many forms in many ways. For example, how many of you would like to be a great friend? Oh, now that's an area of greatness that maybe, say, I've been talking about leadership. What does that have to do with friendship? It has everything to do with friendship. How many of you would like to be a great counselor at summer camp? How many of you would like to be a great camper at summer camp? How many of you would like to be a great worker and be successful in your career? How many of you would like to be a great husband or a great wife? How many of you would like to be greatly loved in your marriage, with your children, in a congregation? How many of you would like to be a great Christian, child of God, someone that God says, I am greatly pleased with your life and how it's developing? How many of you would like to be greatly happy? There's a lot of areas of greatness that has to do with far more things than whether you're the boss over a division at work or not. Greatness in the areas that really count. See, I've been giving you the things that really count in life. It applies to that too. If you want to be great, become a servant. The church has always needed great leaders, and we will in the future. It's always a need. If you respond to what is being said here today, you are positioning yourself for leadership in all facets, including the church. Christ said, "This is what greatness is all about. Serving." Serving is the core, and it's the heart of greatness. It is not, of and by itself, a title or a position. Not of and by itself. Now, people do have titles and positions. Everybody here today is in a position to serve. You're in a position to serve. At the dance tonight, you'll be in a position to serve. Mr. Sefort talked about on the volleyball court, you may be in a position to serve somebody. We're in positions to serve all the time. Every day we have opportunity. True greatness develops right leadership. Tonight at the dance, you will have power. You will have power. You will have the power to hurt or to help. The power to build up or to tear down. You know where that power lies? Right here. It's almost as tough a power to control as it is to grab hold of it and hold it tightly. But in your hands, you're in a position where you hold power. But you know, it all has to do with leadership. It has to do with what is leadership? How you're going to affect and influence other people. How you will lead them to think, to feel, to respond. We'll have more a little bit about that later. So, you know, God is great. Jesus Christ is great in terms of power. We understand that. But you know where their greatness really lies? The tremendous greatness of God lies in that they do great things. That's where the greatest area of it is. It's not only because they have positions of power. That's obvious. God can snap his fingers and command that life exists or doesn't exist. He can do anything he wants to in terms of that power, and we are impressed by that. But their greatest power is because they do great things. Satan also has great power at his disposal, but we don't think of him as a great guy because he doesn't do great things. And when you look at what was Christ the greatest at, you could say, well, you know, creating, sustaining, ruling. That's true. But he was also the greatest of any human that's ever lived at serving. He was the greatest at serving. The greatest thing that was ever done for us humans was an act of service. It saved our lives. In the act of laying down his life, Christ was leading us. He was showing us, here's how you think. Here's how to think. He was showing us how to be and how to live. But it wasn't only in his dying either. All of his life was dedicated to following the will of his Father and to helping others learn about and follow the will of the Father. So he said, you be servants and you be slaves. Don't worry about who's at the right hand, who's at the left hand. Worry about giving your hand. Worry about giving. Be concerned with serving. The next question is, who do we serve? What do we serve? In verse 28, he tells us, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. He said, I did not come to be served. Now you think, well, that's strange, because he is served. Isn't our life devoted to, aren't our lives, I should say, devoted to serving him? It is. We take that position of serving him. You know what? He was doing what Jeroboam refused to do. He was saying, I will serve people. I will lay down my life. I will give my life up. And a strange thing happens. When people understand that, they want to serve him. You want to serve a leader like that. He was the teacher. He knew who he was. He knew very well he was coming back as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. He knew what his responsibility was. He knew what his position was going to be. And he also knew he was going to share his power with us. He was the teacher. He was the leader. And they all recognized him as the leader. But he said, look at me. I'm serving. This is why I came. I came to serve. Christ came to take out the garbage. Christ came to take out the garbage and to do the dirty work. He came to take care of the needs of people. You know, if somebody's not there taking out the garbage, what happens to the garbage? It just piles up. He did the dirty work of life. He cleaned the gunk out of the strainer. Godly leaders have a mission. Godly leaders, and a young person can be a godly leader. A godly leader recognizes they have a mission. They understand that God has given them a purpose in life, and they understand that God has given them a responsibility to help other people with their purpose in life. And it's all the same purpose. They understand that. And that becomes their biggest concern in life, is fulfilling their God-ordained mission to be in the family of God, to have eternal life, and to help other people get to the same point. That's where they are coming from. And in the process of doing that, they understand, as I impact other people, I have a job to help that person be what God wants them to be. Whether you're a new daddy, or a new husband, or a new wife, no matter what you are, a new counselor at camp, you realize, I'm here to help in some way, to impact in some way, great or small, other people and their mission in life and what God has given them. Christ came for that. Kingship is not just for the kingdom of God. Kingship is rulership. And there are many things in life that we rule and we're practicing. Every day we practice learning to lead the way Christ would have us lead. So Jesus Christ had a mission. He came from God to do that. He was dedicated to filling it. As a result, he served. He served. He was serving God and serving man. And we revere him and we look to him as our great leader. Now he tells us to do the same thing. Christ was simply doing what all kings are supposed to do. We realize we are all in preparation for ruling in the kingdom of God. Let's go to Deuteronomy 17. I'd like for you to look at a principle of leadership here that is so hard for humans. But God told Israel, you know, in my nation, among my people, I'd like for you to be different kings. Be a different type of king than you see all around you. So he laid out some standards. Deuteronomy 17, verse 16, speaking of anybody who is going to be king over them, he said, but he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. God doesn't like horses? No. There's a problem here. You see the key in two little words. For himself. There's something about people doing things that turns their mind. Is it wrong to have a horse? I had a horse when I was a kid. I lived in Texas. All Texans have horses. I mean, don't believe it. There's nothing wrong with wanting a horse. There's nothing wrong with things like that. But there's something he's driving at here, multiplying horses for himself. For the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again. There's something very symbolic in this, returning to Egypt to get horses. There's a great lesson in life. It means returning to the way of the world's thinking to get something for yourself, to start thinking that way in terms of, I have the power to get stuff. He says that begins taking us away from godly leadership. Verse 17, neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. Now, we saw a wonderful video this morning about purity. You know, our culture doesn't multiply wives. People in our culture would laugh and point condemning fingers at Mormons of 100 years ago who would multiply wives and practice polygamy. And the same people who laugh will multiply sexual conquest to themselves and not bat an eye and think, that's fine. Back then, they just married them. Today, we don't bother to marry. We just go out and have whoever we want in our culture. And as was brought out in that video, it's serving your future wife or your husband when you protect and you guard not only your own purity, but their purity as well. As he asked the young men in that video, will you be a thief or a warrior? A thief is out to get something for themselves. They're self-serving. The warrior is serving other people. I will protect the purity of my sister. I will protect, and I mean spiritual sister. I will protect, I will guard the sanctity of marriage for somebody else's future wife. I will protect and guard, I will serve my future mate by guarding the sanctity of what God has said. That's a way of serving. They're not serving their own desires. Because when we serve our own desires, we create garbage. It creates garbage, and somebody has to go clean it up. It's hard. Nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. And it shall also be, this is interesting, also it shall be when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book from the one before the priest, the Levites. When you became a king in Israel, you had to handwrite the equivalent of, in my Bible, 254 of these pages. The king had to handwrite it out, write out the law. Now, what is the value of doing that? I lost my place. Well, he says here in verse 19, not only is he to write it, but it shall be with him. I would guess so. If I'm going to labor and write out that whole Torah, I don't want it to be lost. You know, I want that work. There's a lot of effort that goes into that. It'll be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life. Because godly leadership always has to be refreshed. The law of God always has to be kept constant there because there's so much beating against it to tear it away. Read it all the days of your life so that he may learn to fear the Lord his God. To really respect, first of all, where this is coming from. To have a deep, abiding respect for God, number one. And to be careful. It keeps us careful to observe all the words of this law and these statutes. In verse 20, and that his heart may not be lifted above his brethren. God was telling the Israelites, you're a king, but you're a brother. And when you become a king, it's very easy to have the heart start changing. The biggest problem with kings is heart problems. The heart starts changing and it starts getting above their brethren. What happens then in leadership? What happens in a home if a brother, let's say a family of four, and if the oldest brother or sister starts lording it over the other siblings? What happens to the unity in the home? What happens if daddy decides, you know, I in the big cheese here. And he starts operating that way, where his heart is lifted above. Above his family. Now, he's in a position of leadership. But one can be in a position of leadership and exercise godly, strong leadership without having the heart being above other people. And that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, and that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. It makes for a healthy country. It makes for a healthy family. It makes for a healthy congregation. It makes for a healthy church. It makes for a healthy business. It makes for a healthy school, no matter what area of leadership is exercised. It makes for healthy friendships. When friends have a heart of service to their friends, it makes for healthy relationships all the way around. Girls, what are you looking for in a future husband? I would suggest look to see if he's a server or a self-server. Look to see in his family, in relationships with others, is his heart lifted above? Is his mind on the Word of God? Is there a fear of God? Because it's really only in here you're going to find those principles of godly leadership. Look for leadership. Guys, what are you looking for in a girl to marry? Same thing. Your wife is going to exercise tremendous leadership in the family. She'll even lead you if it's a healthy marriage. When leadership means influencing other people in a right and godly way. That's what a good husband-wife team does. They work together. You know what God was telling the king? He says, you know, don't go out there and turn self-centered and start trying to pull everything in, because it starts taking away from other people. God was telling the kings, he was telling leaders, it's not about you. It's not about you. It's about God, and it's about these folks here. You have an opportunity, a God-given responsibility, to help and to take them in the direction they need to go and to influence them properly. Christ did these very things. And Christ was strong. He was not weak in his leadership. You know, there is a word that goes around, two words that float around a lot today, and they're not bad words, about this concept. It's called servant leadership. I was talking with somebody a while back, and they said, we have to be pretty careful about this servant leadership stuff. They said, you know, if you take it too far, you'll put yourself in a position of weakness. And you will put yourself, you know, leaders have to take charge, and all this serving concept, if you take it too far, it'll make you mushy and mousy. I said, then you don't understand what servant leadership is all about. Because Christ, what did he say? We just read it. I came to serve. We don't think of him as weak and mousy, do we? But there are misconceptions. Servant leadership is not being a servant to the whims of all people. Servant leadership does not mean caving in and walking around just, your wish is my command, kids. I'm your daddy, but I'm here to serve you. What do you want me to do? Just tell me what you want, and I'll do it. That's not servant leadership. In the kingdom of God, we're going to serve people, not by doing whatever they want us to do. God serves us, but he's not a genie in a bottle that we carry around in our back pocket. Whenever we want something, we, you know, just rub the bottle and he comes out and says, your wish is my command. That's not what servant leadership is about. That's never what Christ did. You remember when Mrs. Zebedee came to him? She said, would you grant me this wish? And he said, no. He wasn't here to just do whatever people wanted. But you know what he did do? For her and her sons, and eventually for all the rest of them. You know what he did? He took them to where they needed to be. He led them in their thinking, and he said, here's the problem with what you're saying. Here's how you think. He served them by taking them to where they needed to be and helping them to change their concepts. That is strength. That's a strong person when you can help people move from a misplaced position to where God wants them to be. He understood, you're going off in the wrong direction, so let me move you over here. And he did it in a very wonderful way. Servant leadership is not serving people's wants, including our own. It's serving their needs. It is serving their needs. Christ was a wonderful example of that. His focus was always there. That was the beauty of his leadership. At times he would teach them. At times he would elaborate on certain things. At times he would, as we heard in the sermonette, encourage them. At times he would correct them. Sometimes he corrected them very gently. And other times he let the hammer down. Not real often, but he always knew what the person needed, and his desire was to help them out. Wherever they were, that's what he wanted to do. And Jesus Christ's heart was never lifted above his brethren. He was a perfect example of that. So these are core issues of service. Now let me shift gears a little bit and give you a few points about what is so great about the mind of service. Why does service orientation develop strong leaders? If you become a young person who's geared towards serving, why will that make you a stronger leader in life? Well, there are a few reasons. These are certainly not all. But for one reason, we'll start here. Serving fills needs. And when needs are met, people and organizations get stronger. Serving fills needs, and when needs are met, people and organizations grow stronger. The opposite, self-serving induces weakness. Self-serving creates fractures, gaps, problems in people's lives. Now, you can use as an example the family structure. I asked you earlier this example. What is the effect in a family when one person is self-absorbed? Any person in the family, father, mother, kids, grandpa, grandma, aunts, uncles, what happens when one person is self-absorbed? Well, it starts creating problems. When they have the me first, my way attitude, it starts irritating people. It creates a mood. It bothers people. It pulls the family down. Self-absorbed people do not make good husbands and wives and fathers and mothers or friends, leaders. They don't make good leaders. They don't make good bosses. They don't make good workers. Self-absorbed is a bad thing to see, self-absorption. The teen years are good years to start building the habit of observation. It's a good time to build the habit of observing people. What makes people tick? What makes things work in life? And again, when you're thinking about a future mate, analyzing, is this person self-serving or are they geared to serving others? The server will build a strong family. The self-server will drain the life out of a family. Very important. A second thing about strength in serving is that servants have a better understanding about life, and therefore they are smarter. I'm not talking about IQ, they're just smarter about life. Serving people have a better understanding of life. Why is it that way? Well, because takers think about themselves. Takers are inwardly focused. They think about themselves. And when we get thinking about ourselves, that really limits our view. We see about as far out as our hands can reach. A server is thinking about other people, and their view and then starts extending past their own little world. And if their mind is geared towards serving, in order to serve effectively, they also then have to analyze cause and effect. They have to analyze, why is this a problem? They have to analyze what can be done to help this person. They start understanding so much more about how life works. They become solution-oriented. They become people who see down the road. And they just simply become smarter about life. As a result, they're in a better, stronger position because servers make better decisions. Servers make better decisions. You know, in the home, again, let's use that example. The father, who is a servant, is going to make his decisions in the family based on what is the best thing for my family. What is the best thing that will lead my children, that will take care of all of our needs? I have decisions to make. What is the best thing for them? He decides then, based on that, how he uses his time, where he puts his energy, how he handles his kids when he disciplines them or when he teaches them. He starts thinking about the whole family and how it works together. And he starts making better decisions. And there's something else. When a husband and wife are working together, and they both have the same mission, they're there to serve and to build that family according to a godly model. You know what? That's a family that submission is not a big issue. They don't go to war about whether they have to submit to one or the other, because they're working together for the same thing. They're working to fill the needs. Their goal is, how can I help build people? How can I help strengthen everybody in this family? That's where they will be coming from. And you know, I'll tell you something else that relates to that. Sometimes the leader won't make the right decision. Sometimes we make mistakes in decisions. But if the whole family knows where the heart of that leader is, if they know the heart of mom and the heart of dad is for the good of this family, they can handle the decisions that weren't the best. It creates a whole relationship in the family that makes life work effectively. So that even if maybe the occasional decision isn't as good, that's okay. They can handle it. It's hard to handle when you sense that somebody is operating from their own selfish interest and it was a bad decision, and then that hurts everybody. You lose respect. Servers make better decisions because they observe life. The child, the 12-year-old who is learning to serve and learning to think like a servant, will notice, hey, the dishes are piled up. That's strange. Mom isn't feeling well. She's overburdened. Hey, I'll take 5 minutes out of my busy life of watching, you know, cartoons, and I will go wash the dishes. I will put them away because mom needs some help. The 12-year-old who's not thinking in service won't even see the dirty dishes. They'll go, Mom, I don't have a clean glass to drink out of. They're not thinking. They're not observing. Why are things working the way they are? What can I do? You see it develop in children as they grow older. As they develop the ability to think outwardly and serve, you see them developing their leadership. You can choose to do that at a very early age. It has to do with character. They are preparing. The child at 12 who starts observing and thinking about how can I serve in my family better is preparing for much greater things in life. They're preparing for leadership. They're developing leadership. There's another thing about strength in serving. Servers are happier. Servers are happier because servers take pleasure in other people's happiness. Takers take pleasure out of things. Servers value things that last. Christ washed feet, and he said, you know, if you do this, you'll be happy. You're happier if you serve. It's just the law of life. It doesn't make sense to a lot of people, but servers care. And people who care are happier people. And happier people are more positive, and positive people are more effective leaders. There's another thing about strength and leadership when it comes to serving. Servers are leaders because they are willingly made leaders by other people. They are willingly made leaders by other people. True godly leadership is seen, and people gladly follow that. Jeroboam did not operate that way. That's why the elder said, look, if you serve them, they will make you their leader. They will serve you because they'll know your heart. And it becomes so much more powerful in the whole relationship with people. Servers affect lives in very positive ways. They are a great example, and they have a great impact on people's lives. You know, you go to the dance tonight. Okay, you're, say, a 15, 16-year-old girl, and the best-looking, the sharpest-dressed, the wittiest guy that you've had a crush on since last year's camp asks you to dance. Then he asks you for the next dance and the third dance, and after that he says, you know, I got my driver's license this summer. Let's go to Starbucks tonight after the dance. Have a late latte. Now, the service-minded girl, the girl who is really learning to be a servant, about the third or fourth dance will say, you know, there's a girl from our church area who's here. She's been going through a tough time. She's a little shy and nobody's dancing with her. Would you go dance with her a couple of dances? And would you talk to some of your friends and have them go dance with her? Because she really needs this. Crunch time, decision time, will I spend my evening dancing with Sweet Thing, or will I sacrifice him for the sake of somebody who really needs it more than I do? They need attention. That's a test of serving. You know what it is? It's a test of leadership. And any guy out here who is developing godly leadership will do two things. Number one, he'll go dance. He'll go dance with that person. He'll ask them, and he'll do so graciously. And it won't be a one time around the floor, okay, music's over, back to the wall, and I'll go back to her. Won't be that way. Won't be that way. And secondly, he will be inspired by the leadership of the girl. Well, there are lots of ways we lead one another. It means helping each other, just helping one another in very positive ways. Let me show you something that's a little more, read something to you, a little more powerful than that. Heard a sermon at the feast this year in Hawaii. And I asked the man for this story because it's very moving. He said, one day when I was a freshman in high school, I saw a kid from my class walking home from school. His name was Kyle. It looked like he was carrying all of his books. I thought to myself, why would anyone bring home all of his books on Friday? He must really be a nerd. I had quite a weekend planned, parties and a football game with my friends tomorrow afternoon, so I shrugged my shoulders and went on. As I was walking, I saw a bunch of kids running towards him. They ran at him, knocking all of his books out of his arms and tripping him so he landed in the dirt. His glasses went flying, and I saw them land in the grass about 10 feet from him. He looked up, and I saw this terrible sadness in his eyes. My heart went out to him, so I jogged over to him, and as he crawled around looking for his glasses, I saw a tear in his eyes. As I handed him his glasses, I said, those guys are jerks. They ought to get a life. He looked at me and said, thanks. There's a big smile on his face. It was one of those smiles that showed real gratitude. I helped him pick up his books and asked him where he lived. As it turned out, he lived near me, so I asked why I'd never seen him before. He said he had gone to a private school before now. I would never have hung out with a private school kid before. We talked all the way home, and I helped him carry his books. He turned out to be a pretty cool kid. I asked him if he wanted to play football on Saturday with me and my friends. He said yes. We hung around all weekend, and the more I got to know Kyle, the more I liked him. My friends thought the same of him. Monday morning came, and there was Kyle with the huge stack of books again. I stopped him and said, "Boy, you're really going to build some serious muscles with this pile of books every day." He just laughed and handed me half of his books. Over the next 4 years, Kyle and I became best friends. When we were seniors, we began to think about college. Kyle decided on Georgetown, and I was going to Duke. I knew that we would always be friends and that the miles would never be a problem. He was going to be a doctor, and I was going for business on a football scholarship. Kyle was valedictorian of our class. I teased him all the time about being a nerd. He had to prepare a speech for graduation. I was so glad it wasn't me having to get up there and speak. Graduation day, I saw Kyle. He looked great. He was one of those guys that really found himself during high school. He filled out, actually looked good in glasses. He had more dates than me, and all the girls loved him. Sometimes I was jealous. Today was one of those days. I could see that he was nervous about his speech, so I smacked him on the back and said, "Hey, big guy, you'll be great." He looked at me with one of those looks, the really grateful one, and smiled. "Thanks," he said. As he started his speech, he cleared his throat and began. "Graduation is a time to thank those who helped you make it through those tough years. Your parents, your teachers, your siblings, maybe a coach, but mostly your friends. I'm here to tell all of you that being a friend to someone is the best gift you can give them. I'm going to tell you a story." I just looked at my friend with disbelief as he told the story of the first day we met. He had planned to kill himself over the weekend. He talked of how he had cleaned out his locker so his mom wouldn't have to do it later and was carrying all of his stuff home. He looked hard at me and gave me a little smile. Thankfully, I was saved. My friend saved me from doing the unspeakable. I heard the gasp go through the crowd as this handsome, popular boy told us all about his weakest moment. You might say, when the garbage had gotten real deep. I saw his mom and dad looking at me and smiling that same grateful smile. Not until that moment did I realize its depth. Never underestimate the power of your actions. With one small gesture, you can change a person's life. For better or worse, God puts us all in each other's lives to impact one another in some way. Yeah, leadership is all about power. It's about the power to help. It's about the power to serve. Please, be a leader. Let's start off from today recognizing that the real value of leadership in the minds of God is service. And in that lies the heart of being a leader.